From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack alongside host Evan Dawson.
Am I supposed to say hi?
I thought so. Okay. Here we go. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
It's okay. Given the recent presidential primary results, it's probably no surprise that politics was at the center of a number of conversations this week. We'll start with an interesting question about scandal.
We asked Gary Craig and Dave Andreotta from the Democrat and Chronicle to weigh in on how they cover scandal. In other words, when is a politician's private life off limits and when does it rise to the level of news?
There are things that are off limits, but it's because of the context of the race that we're talking about or the office that we're talking about, that whatever the naughty thing that this person did wasn't necessarily a reflection of the job that they're doing, their performance in office, and it wasn't necessarily a negative reflection on something that they're espousing to do, right? Like, you know, upholding some sort of moral standard.
Gary, does it change for you the higher? Well, go ahead. Why don't you respond?
Well, no, I was going to say, I think if you look at some of the affairs, the liaisons that became news in the aftermath of Clinton, part of that, you know, some of those folks, they were getting hit for the hypocrisy. Some of the folks who were Clinton's biggest critics when, you know, their skeletons became unearthed. You know, had it not been for the stance they took during the Clinton scandal, perhaps that wouldn't have been news. But I think, as Dave said, it's such a case-by-case scenario.
Okay. Well, does the standard change the higher the office that we go? The closer you get to the White House, does it become more fair game for scrutiny, Gary?
I have to say I'm speaking on behalf of myself, but
of course.
I would definitely say so. I would definitely say there's, you know, from whether it's town supervisor to state legislator to Congress to president, there is kind of a fluid threshold, I would argue, as to what may be scandalous and what may not be.
Staying with politics, we welcomed Mark Cassini to the show. He's a Republican who is once again challenging Democratic Congresswoman Louise Slaughter.
A lot of listeners wanted to know if Mark is going to support Donald Trump. Right now, there aren't too many members of Congress or congressional candidates who are supporting Trump. Here's why Cassini says he will support Donald Trump this fall.
I haven't decided who I'm going to support, but the reality is it's going to be Donald Trump. And so if he's the eventual nominee, I will support him. I do not like some of the things that have been said. I will be frank with you. I don't like his comments about banning all Muslims into the United States. I did not like his comment about John McCain. But having said that, the likelihood is it will be Donald Trump. I don't see any path forward for any of the other candidates. I hear all the scenarios about a brokered convention, so on and so forth. I think after Florida, it's going to be pretty clear it is Donald Trump.
We saw a lengthy New York Times piece. Maggie Haberman and John Martin wrote a piece about the Republican establishment looking around now saying, well, boy, we didn't think it was going to get this far. What can we do to stop him? And if we can't, what happens? And they quoted Mitch McConnell privately telling other Senate candidates, if it's Donald Trump, don't worry, we will drop him like a hot rock. In other words, McConnell is saying we can win elections for the Senate, and I'm sure Republican leaders in the Congress will say we can win elections even if he's at the top of the ticket and we don't have to support him. So why would you support him if there's all these things that he has done and said that you don't like?
Well, the one thing that Donald Trump brings to the campaign, if he were to be the nominee, is that he is an outsider. He is not the same old that we hear. With all due respect to the dynasty candidates like the Jeb Bushes and the Hillary Clintons, I've already heard the 10-point plans, the 20-point plans, the 30-point plans, the 40-point plans, and nothing ever gets done. And that's what the American people are frustrated with. Forget Donald Trump for a moment. People are disappointed at all the promises that have been made that never come to fruition. They're disappointed because the economy is struggling, because their kids can't find jobs, because they're worried about whether they themselves are going to be able to make it to retirement before they get laid off. They're frustrated, they're upset, and they don't see anyone in the establishment, either in the Democrat or Republican parties, that will do something different. They want a breath of fresh air and they want strength. People are willing to listen to that.
Yeah, well, they're willing to listen. And I get everything you just said. I understand the frustration people feel with politics, politicians, what they perceive to be a lack of either genuine leadership or authenticity. But you're going to put it all in a vessel as immature, as juvenile, as often vulgar as that.
Well, let me jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
We don't have a perfect choice. We have over 300 million people in the country, and every single one of the candidates that we have, Democrat or Republican, are flawed. And they're not just flawed, they're really flawed. But you have to determine what would be the best candidate to move the country forward in the direction that we needed to go in to solve some of the biggest problems we have. And that's the difficult choice. As I said, my choice is Carly Fiorina, and that's not going to happen.
But I don't know what Donald Trump's going to do, because he says, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do it. The sheer force of will. At some point,
he's got to come up with some specifics. I think you're dead on.
No, apparently he doesn't.
No, he has to. I think
apparently he doesn't. I've been wrong about this. I keep thinking this is not going to fly. It's flying beautifully in the Republican primaries.
I will tell you, frankly, he needs to have specifics. I think it's time to put up, to give us some details.
Speaking of Donald Trump, we had the chance to talk about for-profit education. Donald Trump is getting sued by a number of former students of Trump University.
The former students say it was a scam, costing them tens of thousands of dollars. I sat down with author Kevin Connell, whose new book is all about the for-profit college industry. Connell wants that industry shut down because it tends to target poor people, often with very little return, a lot of loan debt, and weak job prospects.
Trump University is the quintessential example, and I'm hoping that, you know, I made the point to several people that this only affected a couple thousand students. The industry affects over 2 million students each year, so it's great that it's getting the notoriety just because of Donald Trump's status in the Republican Party. I do hope that, however, this is used more as a looking glass into the industry as a whole. It's the emphasis on advertising and recruiting. If you look at budgets, roughly 40% of, on average, of these major for-profit colleges is made up of both profit and advertising. And largely, that is the result of, it's a model that relies on churn. So the student outcomes are so poor at these places. A great example is at Bridgepoint Education Incorporated, which owns and operates Ashford University. They have an 84% withdrawal rate within 4 months for their associate's degree programs.
84% within 4 months dropout.
Correct. And these numbers are from a series of reports filed through the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, as well as the Government Accountability Office, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There have been a litany of investigations filed on this industry as a result.
And with that, enough said this week about Donald Trump.
Okay, good. Let's turn to the sexy side of science now.
The scientific world was rocked by news that we've detected gravitational waves for the first time.
It's a story that goes back 100 years when Einstein first predicted that gravitational waves exist, but he also said we'd probably never be able to build something sensitive enough to prove it. And that's where Einstein was wrong.
First, scientists had to build an L-shaped device with finely tuned mirrors. Then they had to figure out what a gravitational wave would sound and look like.
So here's what happened. More than a billion light years away, two black holes merged. That created a massive ripple of energy in the form of a gravitational wave. And that wave has been traveling across the universe ever since. In September, that wave passed through the Earth. Isn't that cool?
It's very cool. And almost 10 years ago, RIT scientists helped create a model for what a gravitational wave would be like if it existed. In September, the real thing came to Earth. We had the scientists in studio talking about that moment when they could find if a real gravitational wave would be anything like what they modeled.
It was exactly what we thought.
Was it really?
Yes. It was shocking.
Everyone's jaw hit the floor because they looked at the data and they said, This can't be right. Someone must be faking it.
We were very fortunate that this was so loud, because normally we shouldn't be able to just look at the time series and see, oh, look, there's the wave. But in fact, this time, this was such a strong signal, you know, again, relative to the very reduced noise that LIGO has compared to before, that we could actually even see this in the data.
Carlos, how did you find out?
It was speechless. Then
did you find out that day? I mean, did everybody sort of spread it around? Did they call you?
What happened? Immediately this spread in the whole community of scientists involved.
I think Marco's email went to the entire collaboration, in fact. So as PI of the RIT group, I said, oh, we better write to everybody in the group and say, hey, by the way, don't talk to anyone outside the LSE about this yet.
And then disbelief, because it was almost too good to be true, too perfect. In fact, binary black holes are perfect mathematical machines. They're one of the few objects that we can describe very accurately, very mathematical, very clean system as they happen in the universe. So we had this very accurate prediction of how they collide and what they produce and what we should have observed. And when you see this, that nature realized this, you can still not believe it. So it took a couple of weeks to convince myself and many of our colleagues. And as Stephen said, it was 5 months of very detailed review, trying to see things, cross-check, seeing from different angles, make sure that it wasn't nothing else but the signal of the collision of these two black holes.
Richard, that day when you found out, were you also thinking that would be remarkable, but what if it's not? I mean, what was going through your mind?
I was very happy because this sort of comparisons are my bread and butter. That and some colleagues and I had gone out on a limb and said that we should probably see something very soon. Although I didn't quite bet someone. I was going to talk to Stephen Ballmer and bet him, you know, maybe we'll detect something during an engineering run. I should have taken that bet.
Why did you think we should see something very soon? Explain that.
So the universe, LIGO is an extremely conservative plan to detect things that we know are out there. We have seen what's left over after massive stars explode, some black holes and some neutron stars. And we've seen pairs of neutron stars because occasionally they rotate rapidly and emit pulses, which we call pulsars. And we've seen them orbit around each other. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize awarded for discovering a pair of them orbit around each other. And we know that they're going to gradually get closer and closer together until eventually they coalesce. And we can just count up how many there are and say, oh, well, if LIGO, you make LIGO this sensitive, then it's going to start finding them. So we knew that LIGO would detect those. But LIGO is more sensitive to things that are bigger.
Let's wrap the week with a conversation about words. We welcomed memoir author Sonia Livingston to Connections. Her new book is called Queen of the Fall.
Writers and Books chose Sonia's book for their annual If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book events. And I noticed in reading her book that she lingers on certain words, remarking about how perfectly suited they are. And our conversation turned in a direction probably neither one of us expected.
I definitely like language, and I think sometimes I can go too far with that. You know, some readers don't like language as much, but when you look at writing, and especially nonfiction, there's this line, there's content versus style, and I definitely like to play with language a whole lot. And I write poetry, but have settled on the essay as my chosen form, so I think that love of language and sounds, the sounds of things, and noticing that, I think we all do that as human beings. When we speak to each other, if you were to hear, it's like we have great rhythm, we say really interesting things, but I've always loved paying attention to that.
But what I'm wondering is this. The word cirrhosis definitely it kind of sounds awful.
It is, yeah, and it is awful. And it's an ugly word.
It's an ugly word. Mm-hmm. It's an ugly thing. Sterile, I agree. It has a jagged...
Scalpel sound.
A scalpel. Mm-hmm. That's what she writes in the book, and I couldn't agree more. Do those words have that sound because we know what the meaning is, and then we start to ascribe that? In other words, if the word pleasure and the word sterile were flipped, would we think the same thing? If the word sterile meant pleasure, would all of a sudden we say, oh, sterile, it rolls off the tongue. It's good.
Right.
I don't think so,
no.
Which is why I think there are certain words you land on. But I'm wondering, do we do that to the words, or do the words naturally have some of those edges?
Yeah. A linguist would have a great answer for this, but I do notice that words that are pleasing tend to be very soft, right? Like I can't imagine sterile replacing the word suave, which sounds exactly like what it is, right? Like somebody who's suave is just suave.
Yeah.
You know, but in harder words tend to use hard consonants. So I don't know the origin of that, but it doesn't seem like a mistake. I think we know what we're about with language.
I mean, like if the word gout, which is like a dull hammer of a word.
It's a terrible word. Yeah.
If gout and chocolate were replaced, there's no
Americans
way.
Americans would be underweight. Yeah.
There's no way.
Right.
There's no way I'd be like, oh,
I need some more gout.
I love dark gout. I like milk gout, but I really love dark gout.
Right. And have you tried the Dutch gout?
Have you tried the Dutch gout?
Right.
So I do think there are certain words that really are perfect for their purpose.
I think you're right.
But your book had me thinking, like, if we reverse them, would we feel the same way? And I think the answer is no, which is why I do think certain ones stand out to you. Anyway, that digression.
No, it's really interesting. I'm really interested in language. I love that you were thinking about those things.
And now you want to go get some dark gout.
I might think twice next time I get gout.
What a way to end the week.
You've probably never wanted gout so much in your life.
Or maybe I've never felt so nauseated by chocolate
before. Maybe that too.
Anyway, a reminder that you can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS 89.5 FM, Finger Lakes Public Radio.
We're always available also on the WXXI mobile app. From all of us at Connections and Weekend Connections, I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack, and we'll talk to you Monday. We'll